I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What would it take to change the lives of poor children, not one by one, but in big numbers and in a big way? That's the question that led Jeffrey Canada to create the Harlem Children's Zone, a place to test new and controversial ideas about poverty and education. We'll speak with author and journalist Paul Tough about his experience writing his book about the Harlem Children's Zone. Plus, we'll have a special presentation from our friends at Next American City. As part of their Urban Nexus series, they've brought in Mark Valianatis of the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College. He'll tell us about the transformation of Los Angeles from an agricultural hub to a sprawling metropolis and how it might regain its agrarian heritage. So stick around for Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week with a cold and a voice that won't quite work. But Paul Tough is our first guest. He's an editor of the New York Times Magazine. He's written often about the education reform movement, but his latest and most expansive work is his book, Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. The book is a portrait of the creator of the Harlem Children's Zone and an inside glimpse at the operation of that controversial and innovative educational experiment. Early in your book, Paul, you write about two contrasting views of how to fix poverty, the ideas of Charles Murray and William Julius Wilson. Recap those arguments for me.
Well, this was after more than a decade of the war on poverty. And what Charles Murray figured out in his book, Losing Ground, was that despite all of this extra attention and extra money that was being spent in poor communities in the late 60s and the 70s, things in lots of ways had gotten worse during that period. So the poverty rate hadn't really changed at all. But meanwhile, the single parenthood rate had gone up, the crime rate had gone up, and in lots of ways, things had just become much worse in inner cities during that period. Charles Murray concluded that it was government assistance itself that had caused this problem, that just the fact of welfare checks had created this culture of dependency in inner cities that was holding people back. And so his solution was to just get rid of the safety net altogether, and that would create more self-reliance and that would help poor people help themselves. William Julius Wilson, in response to that book in the early 80s, argued that, yes, things had gotten a lot worse in inner cities, but that it wasn't about government aid at all. It was about bigger changes in the economy. And the two that he points to, one was actually a positive social change, which was that for middle-class blacks, there was not the same kind of restrictions on where they could live that there had been before World War II. And so a lot of them left black neighborhoods like Harlem and moved to the suburbs or to other parts of the city. And that was good for them, but what it did was left only poor people in those black neighborhoods. At the same time, the economy was going through a huge change and lots of manufacturing jobs were starting to disappear. And those were the jobs that African Americans and especially uneducated African Americans had been able to hold. So that created this sort of self-perpetuating process where these very new types of ghettos were created that were almost all poor and all black. And what William Julius Wilson points out in his book was that then led to a lot of sort of social dysfunctions that fed on themselves.
But then debate over a later book by Charles Murray, The Bell Curve, led to a conclusion that what we need to do, what we need to focus on is improving the skills of poor children. First of all, I guess, do you buy that conclusion? And if you do, then what stands in the way of doing that?
I do. It was one of the surprising things about my research that, you know, I just assumed that The Bell Curve was not a book that actually had much of use in it at all. It was criticized, and I think rightly so, when it came out for attributing the achievement gap to genes, saying that the real difference between poor people and middle-class people is something innate and genetic. But one thing that I found out in my research is that there were actually people who took sort of a few facts out of that book and built on them in a useful way, facts that didn't have anything to do with the genetic argument and actually sort of undercut that genetic argument, that just pointed out that actually more so than ever before, skills are crucial to succeeding in the economy, and that unskilled people were getting stuck in poverty and were having all sorts of negative outcomes connected to that lack of skills. So yeah, I think that started this big sea change in how we understand poverty and what causes it and what can solve it. And to me, it's a central and very important and very accurate understanding of what the situation is.
So what then stands in the way of poor children acquiring the skills that would make them successful in life and get out of poverty?
It's a good question. I think that there are really lots of obstacles to poor children getting the skills that they need. There are certainly obstacles at home, that they tend to have parents who are not well educated, and often parents who have not been sort of indoctrinated the way that middle class parents have about the importance of early childhood education and stimulation. And so they tend in those first few years of life to get much less cognitive stimulation than middle class kids do, fewer books, less conversation, less of all the sorts of inputs that middle class and upper middle class kids get. And then I think the schools are the other part of that equation, that once they do get to school, there are things about the way the schools are set up and organized that tend to make the gap worse rather than better. And so rather than catching up the way they need to once they get to school, they're just falling further and further behind.
So are those the twin problems that Jeffrey Canada set out to address with his Harlem Children's Zone?
Yes. Well, I would actually add one other, a third, which is the community. So the family, the school, and the community are the three parts of the problem, and they're also the three parts of the solution. And a big part of what the Harlem Children's Zone has focused on is just restoring Harlem as a community, literally forming tenant associations, cleaning up parks, just making it feel like a neighborhood where there are successful things going on instead of just crime and failure.
To address the question of family, he started something called Baby College. Tell me about that and what you found in terms of its success or lack thereof.
Yeah, Baby College is one of the most interesting parts of the Harlem Children's Zone program. And for me as a reporter, it was the most fascinating and sort of the most fun part of my reporting as well. So it is a 9-week series of parenting classes that poor parents in Harlem enroll in. About 100 parents enroll each session, and they're about 4 or 5 a year, so about 500 parents go through it each year. And the main thing that they learn about, there are two things. They mainly learn about discipline and about cognitive development. And they just learn different approaches, learn them and also discuss them and debate them. It really has a feel more of a conversation than a lecture. But in the process, they're learning things like the importance of reading to your child early on, the benefits of different sorts of discipline like negotiation and timeouts rather than corporal punishment. And Jeff Canada's theory is that all of this information, all these new ideas about how to deal with kids between 0 to 3 just sort of swept through middle class and upper middle class neighborhoods not that long ago, mostly in the 80s and 90s. And kids now in those neighborhoods are just raised very differently than kids were a generation ago. But all of those changes and all of that information and all of that research didn't really penetrate neighborhoods like Harlem. And so that's what he's trying to do, just give those parents all that same information that is just become common knowledge in lots of other parts of the city.
Has it made a difference?
It has. Baby College is something that I think is pretty difficult to measure scientifically how much of an effect it's having, partly because it sort of goes against Jeff's basic philosophy to have a real scientific study where you had a treatment group and a control group who want to go to baby college but don't go to baby college, because his goal is to literally have 80 or 90% of the parents in Harlem in the 97 block zone, the Harlem Children's Zone, enrolled in the program or graduating from the program. So there isn't sort of really rock solid data, but certainly from having gone through it a couple of times, my sense is that anecdotally, at least, there are lots of examples of parents who have changed their behavior, changed their outlook. But it is stuff that's hard to measure. I mean, one thing that really struck me is that, there were certainly parents who stopped using corporal punishment. There were certainly parents who started reading to their child every night. But even more than that, I think it was this sort of deeper sense of responsibility I think that parents in Harlem sometimes feel very disempowered, that they, you know, they're told that they don't know what they're doing, or they feel like, especially if they've had children young, their parents tell them that they don't know what they're doing. And I think institutions like schools also tend to undercut their self-esteem rather than build it up. And so I think one thing that comes through in Baby College is just this message that, you know, you are your child's most important teacher. You have these abilities. You know, you can make this huge difference in your child's life. And I think that that message, more than anything else, is what parents take away from Baby College and what really changes the potential for their kids.
Now, there were data for Promise Academy, the charter school that Jeff Canada set up, and the data weren't good.
Well, it depends what part of Promise Academy you're looking at. So the middle school is something that I spent a few chapters of the book on. So just to back up just a bit, in 2004, in the fall of 2004, this charter school opened, Promise Academy, and it opened with both a kindergarten class and a sixth grade class. So the sixth grade had a rough couple of years, for sure, and they got test results immediately that first year and that second year, because the way New York State works, kids in those grades are getting tested all the time. And their results that first year were pretty bad. I think something in the 20s, 20%, like 25, 27% of kids were passing the state-mandated achievement tests. And those numbers improved over the next couple of years, but they didn't improve enough, especially in English language arts. The math scores actually went up considerably just in those 3 years. The first year, I think 7%, 9% of kids passed, and the third year, 70% of kids were on grade level. So that was a big improvement. But Jeff Canada was really disappointed by the English language scores. And I think that part of it was that the school was going through a lot of growing pains. There were a lot of mistakes made in those first couple of years. But the other part is that something that is proving true in all sorts of schools, if you take kids who are in sixth grade and are not well-educated, not well-prepared, have never really gotten a good education either at home or in school, and only then, only when they're in sixth grade, try to give them an accelerated education, give them extended school days, an extended school year, and lots of attention and lots of stimulation. You can move kids to a certain degree, but it's very difficult to show big jumps for lots of kids, especially in reading. Math is it's something that's true in a lot of charter schools. Math is easier to push kids along on. So all of that is the middle school. At the same time, the kids in the elementary school were moving along through kindergarten, first grade, second grade. And when they got to third grade, they had their first state-mandated test. That's where the tests begin. And these were kids who were on what Jeff calls the conveyor belt. Not only had they gone all the way from kindergarten to third grade, but a lot of them had also been through the pre-kindergarten program. Some of them had been through, their parents had been through Baby College as well. And their scores when they got to third grade were extremely impressive. They were way above average for Harlem, and their English scores were above average for New York City, and their math scores were in the 90s above average for all of New York State. And so as those kids continue on, I think the scores coming out of the elementary school are going to continue to be really good. And when those kids get to middle school, I mean, who knows? But my sense is that they are just going to do much better than the kids who arrived in sixth grade without any of the kind of preparation that they're getting right now.
I was really struck by your writing about Promise Academy, the middle school, and just the reporting was beautiful, and the agonizing that Jeff Canada went through on the staff, and should we give them another chance, and what can we really expect, and conversations between Jeff and the board and the various options they faced. It's beautiful reporting. I'm curious, though, it made me curious. Did you come to this story as an advocate or as a reporter who was not invested in the outcome?
I certainly tried to approach it as a reporter, not invested in the outcome. And, you know, it's hard not to get emotionally attached to kids and to teachers and to what's going on in front of you. And so I certainly wanted those kids to succeed and not to fail. But I did feel like it was important to tell the whole story of what was going on, especially in the middle school. And I think that you're right, there were as many failures as successes in those first few years. One thing that actually has struck me talking to people after the book has come out, and as I think back on my own process, I realize that one thing that Jeff talks about is that there is this kind of emotional pull for people in education, and especially who are working with inner city kids in education. There's this pull towards middle school. A lot of the most successful charter schools started in middle school. And part of the reason for that is that it's very dramatic. You know, these are kids who are just, if they arrive in a school in fifth grade or sixth grade, they're just about to fail. If you don't get them, the chance of them going to prison is very high. The chance of them going to college is very low. But you can still pull some or even most of them back from the brink and give them a decent life. And so that's just the sort of very exciting process. But if you work with kids in starting in kindergarten, first grade, it's much less exciting, but it's much less exciting because it's more successful. It actually just works, and the kids never fall behind. You never get the sense that they're about to fail. And I think that I sort of reflected that in my book as well. So there are three chapters, or four chapters even, from the middle school that are, you know, very intense and filled with lots of ups and downs and emotional moments. And then there's one chapter in the elementary school that is, you know, is sort of much more straightforward. They have a goal to achieve and they achieve it. But in fact, I think what is happening in the elementary school is much more important to it's a much more important period, but it's also much more important to Jeff's theory and the ultimate success of his project. So it is kind of complicated. If I was approaching it as an advocate, I would have spent a lot more time in the elementary school. But I think that a lot of what I wanted to do was just tell a story and a dramatic story, and what was going on in middle school was certainly more dramatic.
Because of that, and because I think it seems to take such an honest look at what went on there, Jeff Canada's picture's on the front of your book. Is he comfortable with the book? It certainly exposes, I think, some of his management weaknesses, and perhaps prior to the writing of this book, he had been held up as we tend to do. Anyone with an idea, who's willing to go for it and is charismatic and, you know, he seemed like he can do no wrong. And that's unfair to any person to put that burden on them, especially when they're tackling a problem like this one. But here his picture is on the front of your book, and whatever it takes, I mean, it certainly, you know, sounds like the mantra. And yet you do expose management and leadership weaknesses on his part. So I'm curious how he feels about the book.
Yeah, I think there are definitely some chapters and some moments that he likes better than others, but he's been very happy with it. He was a great subject in lots of ways, but one of the most important ways was that he really gave me free rein to explore all different parts of his organization and encouraged the staff to talk to me openly and never asked to see what I was writing or even really hear about what I was writing. I think he was a little anxious when he first read the book, and I'm sure there were lots of moments in there that he regretted. But he has certainly said that he is, and I think he really is very, very happy to have the book out there, partly because I think there are a few messages that he wants to get out. One is that it's possible to do something like the Harlem Children's and to have a really comprehensive, integrated set of programs that will change the odds for large numbers of kids in one neighborhood. The other message is that it's really hard to do that. It's just a lot of work, and no matter where you are, where you're trying to do that, it's going to be really complicated, and there are going to be lots of ups and downs. And then I think he also, you know, especially at this moment in his career, and also with the change of administration in Washington, is thinking a lot about how this idea can expand to other cities. And so I think that he feels like it's important to have a book out there that shows how what happens, shows, you know, what he did right, what he did wrong, and that other people can then use and build upon what he's done.
How much do you think the expansion of a Harlem Children's Zone, which President-elect Barack Obama has talked about in his platform, how much does that depend on having someone like Jeffrey Canada as the local leader?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's certainly, If Obama's plan does come to fruition, as I hope it will, and the Harlem Children's Zone is replicated or imitated in 20 cities across the country, I think each of those new institutions is going to need a great leader. But I don't think it's necessarily going to need someone with all the sort of unique skills and experiences that Jeff had. He's someone who grew up in poverty himself, and by a series of flukes and miracles and his own intelligence made it out of the inner city and got to Bowdoin College and to Harvard, and then came back to basically keep spending his entire life working with the sorts of kids that he had grown up with. And that's a pretty rare set of experiences. And I think it might have been necessary to create the first Harlem Children's Zone, to get people to believe in him and dedicate the kind of money that they did. But I think that replications of the Harlem Children's Zone won't necessarily take that particular kind of charismatic leader. I think they'll take certainly very devoted and passionate people, but mostly just really organized, outcome-oriented, focused leaders. And I think there are lots of those in the nonprofit field. In my reporting outside of Harlem, writing about charter schools and writing about schools in New Orleans for the Times Magazine, I feel like I've met lots of people, you know, really inspiring and often young people who I can absolutely picture running one of these things.
You've done a lot of reporting in this area, as you say. Do you see any low-hanging fruit in how to build skills among poor children?
I don't think there are a whole lot of low-hanging fruit. I mean, I think that one of the things that I've concluded is that this sort of comprehensive program is necessary to make the kind of difference that needs to be made, that just doing great pre-kindergarten program is not going to, you know, it'll make a temporary difference for the kids who are enrolled in it if it's well run, but it's not going to make the big kind of difference that we need to make. That said, the one thing that I feel sort of surprised that it hasn't been replicated in other communities and that I think could pretty easily spread is baby college. You know, it's like it takes some money and it takes some work and it certainly takes some sort of cultural sensitivity in order to pull it off, since a lot of what's happening is trying to describe to certain parents a different kind of parenting. But it really, I just think, is a very effective program and runs in a public school. A lot of the people who work there are not highly paid professionals, but just people from the neighborhood who have the skills that they need to get this information across. And I feel like it could very easily exist in all sorts of cities across the country.
You sound as if you are hopeful, after writing this book, that we can do much better by poor children in America.
I am hopeful, yeah. I mean, I think that being in that third grade classroom with the kids who have gone along the conveyor belt and comparing that to a third grade classroom in other schools in Harlem, it just, not only are the scores much better in that class, but it just feels very different. And so, you know, that's both very frustrating because you realize there are a lot more kids in the other sort of classroom, a lot more kids whose potential is not being realized, who aren't being given all the support that they need and that other types of kids get all the time. But it's also, it just shows that with this kind of attention, you don't have to do those sorts of rescue missions that we were talking about in middle school. And kids also don't have to have the kind of outcomes that kids in Harlem have had for so long. They can have a school life and then a career after that that looks much more like the school career and the career of a kid in any middle-class neighborhood, anywhere in the city, anywhere in the country.
Paul, it's a glorious book. Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Paul Tuff is an editor at the New York Times Magazine, and he's the author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. He joined us from his office in New York, and his interview was engineered by Amber Cortez. For a link to Paul's book and more information about the Harlem Children's Zone, we have a link on our site, smartcityradio.com. Now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we go to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Detroit is not a happy city right now. The meltdown of the U.S. auto industry has hit its heartland hard, and Detroit is now being called America's largest shrinking metropolis. It's still the nation's 11th largest city, but with its major corporations failing and a rash of foreclosed properties blighting the city, Detroit is going to have to start thinking about downsizing gracefully. But how? That's the question facing officials in the city, who are slow to get hip to a smaller Detroit, according to a recent article from Bloomberg News. One way the city is getting creative is urban farming. The foreclosure crisis has left thousands of plots of empty or abandoned land throughout the city. Progressive planners have made moves to reuse this empty land for urban farming projects. More than 6 acres across the city have been converted to mini farms so far, and more are on the way. But with about 17,000 more empty acres, the city is still facing a far more barren Detroit than there once was. To face this likely future elegantly, the city's parks department is considering plans to convert many unsold foreclosures into pocket parks. Officials are seeking $47 million from the federal government's neighborhood stabilization plan to help clear these abandoned properties. They hope to be able to replace them with something better and more sustainable. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., President-elect Barack Obama has reportedly made his picks for two key cabinet positions working on urban policy. Sean Donovan, the commissioner of New York City's Department of Housing Preservation and Development, has been picked to head the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the department charged with guiding the nation's housing policy. Donovan previously served as deputy assistant secretary at HUD during the Clinton presidency, and more recently attracted praise for his management of New York's housing department, one of the largest affordable housing programs in the country. And for the newly created White House Office of Urban Policy, the Obama team has tapped Bronx Borough President Adolfo Carrion Jr., according to the New York Post. He's a figure known to be pro-development amongst New York City politicians, and one with a hopeful eye on the mayor's office. With two strong urban voices coming into the White House from New York, we can expect to see a strong New York influence in the nation's newest urban policies. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after this short break, we'll have a special report from our friends at Next American City magazine. We'll hear from Mark Valianatos. He's the author of The Next Los Angeles, and they'll tell us about the history of food and the city of Los Angeles. Stay tuned for more Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Hello to our podcast listeners. I just had a quick note about some of the conversations that are happening on our social networking site, My City. Our listeners are continuing to talk about the topics we bring up on the show, from rent control to mass transit, from your favorite online urbanism tools to why you choose to live in the city in the first place. My City is a place where people who love cities can meet and chat and get great new ideas. Please join us. Send an email to our producer, Scotty Iseri, at scotty@smartcityradio.com. He'll get you all set up. And now, back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. While Paul Tough roughs it through another New York winter, we head out to Southern California to meet with our friends at Next American City. Each month, the magazine heads to a different U.S. city and hosts a lecture series. In Los Angeles, we're headed to the combination think tank art studio known as Farm Lab. Next American City has brought the policy director for the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College, Mark Valianatos. Mark is also the author of the book, The Next Los Angeles, The Struggle for a Livable City, and he's here to speak on food issues in Los Angeles and the history of food and city living.
Well, thanks so much. It's good to see everyone here, and I'm excited to have a chance to talk about food and politics in L.A. And so I wanted to first thank Next American City for sponsoring this discussion. Particularly, I'm really thrilled that they're acknowledging food as an important urban issue and choosing food in Los Angeles' topics to kick off this lecture series that it was described. For a long time, sort of food has taken a back seat as a second-class kind of hippie kind of non-real, not core essential issue for cities in America. That's really changing now, and it's good to see that acknowledged. And I'm also grateful to FarmLab for hosting us. I'm going to talk about three themes of food in Los Angeles and politics and policy. I'm going to try to cover a whole bunch of different topics rather than focusing on a few, just to give a sense of the different diversity and sort of the challenges and opportunities we face here on food. So the first theme I'm going to talk about is growing food. And I am going to give you a 90-second history of human civilization, because I was thinking about this and cities and food and stuff, and I realized that if you think about like the broad overall themes of human history, it basically all boils down to food plus politics. It's all about, it's like the guns, germs, and steel stuff, about which cultures had access to which crops. It's about which empires could harness water to irrigate things. And a big part of that is basically food in cities. So human history, a lot of it is just basically about, can the rulers get enough bread into the city, or if not, they get overthrown. So I want to take three lessons from that before I sort of to weave through my talk today. One is that it's very, very, very weird that we as a society don't think about food in cities very much, with the exception of those of you in this room. I mean, So, I mean, you think about human history, it's like the interrelation between food and cities is so important, but we sort of take it for granted. And that either means that we have a magical food system or a very messed up one, and you know, possibly both. And the second lesson is that being in the city means that, sort of by definition, other people are growing our food other places. This is a picture of farm workers in Oxnard taken from above. And I liked it because the tiny dots on the green field is sort of represents how we sort of ignore the people who make our food and grow our food usually. And that includes myself. Even when I'm working on urban food issues, I don't think enough about farm workers. And finally, there's this counter trend that as soon as cities were started with, you know, surplus food, it'll either be elites and the growth of cities and stuff, those elites and the artists and people in cities started thinking that, wait a minute, there's something corrupt about living in a big city. And it led to people like the eminent Romans, the ancient Romans. The rich people would want to create these villas in the countryside. They want to go out and sort of they idealize the rustic lifestyle. And there's a semi-straight line that goes from that through the sort of English country house to the idealized version of a modern American suburb and then the reality of the suburb. So it's interesting to think that food and the way we grow food allowed us to create cities, and then there's been this running away from the cities in a way that's undercut both food production and the urban form itself. Starting with The Land of Sunshine, which is the title of an old, it was like an old magazine about LA, sort of like Sunset, and had a lot of promotion about, you know, you can move out to California and get 10 acres and a little bungalow and grow your crops and stuff. So that's the first theme I'm going to talk about. And start with a little bit of history. So without citrus, without oranges, Los Angeles would have developed very differently in a different time frame. Because basically at the end of the last century, so the 1870s, 1880s, there's a confluence of rail coming out to California and people figuring out how to do refrigerated rail cars, which then allowed them to ship fruit back from California to the cities of the East Coast. And these were shipped like, it was like a magical thing where you would get an orange and be wrapped in individually wrapped in tissue paper. And there is really expensive commodity. They're especially bred here by federal scientists and private industry. And it led to the first really big migration into Southern California. We tend to think of post-war World War II boom or like later migrations in Latin America. But the really explosive growth period in this region was basically from 1900 to 1920 or 30. The population, you know, it more than tripled between 1900 and 1910, for example. And this is just a snapshot of what agriculture was like in LA County in 1910. 30% of the county was in farmlands. There were 8,000 farms. LA County was I couldn't verify this, I think it was the number one county in the country in terms of agricultural sales. There are a lot of orange trees. And I thought that was funny. There's backyard cows. It's basically cows not on farms. So the way that people might keep chickens or something like that or dogs nowadays, there are 7,000 or 8,000 people just with cows in their backyard just to, you know, get the milk and stuff. Now, to start with that, it doesn't mean to idealize the past or to say that's what we should be moving for. There are problems with this system as it developed. First, the Orange Empire, it's a title of a really cool book about sort of citrus in Southern California, but the Orange Empire is basically the idea that the best use of the land is to grow commodities for export, in this case back east, rather than for people to grow food for themselves. And this whole set of these large citrus growers arose, and they organized themselves into Sunkist and other cooperatives, and they used as labor, even back in 1910, non-white farmers, which were probably primarily Asian at that time, were 30% of tenant farmers with a less than 1% of farm owners. So there's this, even then, there's this unequal system of sort of racist exploitation of Latinos and Asians and African Americans as the labor producing this work. And in terms of gender, it was men picking. Men were out in the citrus fields and women were in the packing house because they had more sensitive hands, they could do the work really quickly. And it also had this idea that, you know, everyone could move out here, we could keep plowing up quasi-desert land and irrigating it and making farms. It sort of contributed to the way we still think about use of space here in LA today. So we jump forward 100 years, or actually to 2002, which is the census of agriculture, the last time it's been done. And we see that right now LA County is the 28th most productive agriculture county in the state of California, not the most productive in the country. So clearly all the growth, all the people coming out to get their piece of that orange in the bungalow sort of undercut that very vision. I threw in Riverside County, Ventura County, as two surrounding counties that still have a decent amount of agriculture. So the medium size of the farm is fairly small. I mean, the average size is bigger because there's some mega farms, but we're still blessed in Southern California with thousands and thousands of small to medium-sized farms. In LA County, they're mainly growing trees. I mean, not food. But we're still producing some food as well in Ventura and San Diego and Riverside, San Bernardino, and particularly Imperial County. So I want to talk about how sort of the vision of someone coming out here being able to grow their own food can be recaptured. And so start off by talking about how people can grow food where they live, how people can sort of take over public spaces, how you can combine with your neighbors for community agriculture, and also critically, because we're never going to grow enough food here inside the city to feed everyone, how you tap into those surrounding surviving farms with distribution. So here's a little modest container garden someone stuck up on Flickr. I have no idea who they are, but it's a good place to start. It's like, you know, if you have a spot in your window box or in your backyard or something, you can grow food. So I lived for a number of years in Pomona, which is a city in East LA County that, like Orange County or Walnut or a number of places, was named back in the glory days of agriculture here in Southern California. And as she's basically a Roman goddess of fruits and vines. And in Ovid's Metamorphosis, the story is basically she likes plants, she doesn't like dudes, so she hides in this walled garden, and she's wooed by a demigod who fails to move her heart, so he transforms himself like into a peasant, and finally she likes him. But I thought this was a good metaphor for like whether or not she was right to hide away, like how you bust out of the walls of your backyard to do agriculture in other kinds of places. And so one is just edible landscaping. Sticking with this classical theme, this is a little ancient poem on landscaping. So it's good to plant trees, but first plant the vines. I'm not sure if this is because this dude was like a drunk or not, but he sort of has the right idea that you need to grow food. There's been a lot of interesting stuff going on in Southern California and elsewhere in transforming lawns into basically garden spaces. In LA, as around the country, people are doing rooftop gardening. This is a garden in downtown Riverside. I think it's an herb garden. We have some disadvantages here in Southern California because we don't have snow. Not all the roofs are built super strong like they are in some places like Chicago. But there's a lot of existing gardens, existing rooftops you can garden on. There are chickens in Los Angeles, and I think because of the agricultural heritage of the city, unlike some other places in the country, we've never had a whole-scale ban on having chickens in your backyard. So it's been sort of a viable option for people for a number of years, and it's sort of hip and exciting nowadays. And taking those things like up a notch, this is a little house in Pasadena, an 8,700 square foot lot. These people are doing all kinds of amazing things with solar and organic agriculture. And so you see they're producing a vast amount of food on this little house. I mean, it's like their total purpose in life. So it's not something that's viable for a lot of people. But it shows that you can actually, if you really want to, you can farm urban, like just in your place. So one thing to be thinking is that, of course, this requires you to actually own land, places to grow food. We want to keep on going to like the mental space and the taking over the public aspect of gardening. This is two examples of guerrilla gardening. And actually, the last issue of Next American City featured another guerrilla gardener. So I picked two more that have happened recently in LA. And this is the idea, just go to a place that's like a wasteland or it's a public space that isn't being used and you plant stuff and maybe you can tend it also and people can get benefits from it. Along the same lines, I'm calling this public domain fruit. Tree people and other nonprofits, they give out trees because they want to restore LA's urban forest. And you can, if you're a community organization, you can get free fruit trees and if you go get trained and stuff. So there's a way you can spread fruit trees, particularly to places where low-income people live and there's not a lot of vegetation, not a lot of places to grow food. You can also expropriate the food. There was a map here that this group called Fallen Fruit at fallenfruit.org had done of a walk through Silver Lake of all the places where there are trees or the branches hung over the streets so that you can basically take it because it's out in the public. So that's another way you can sort of think about how you can access food. In that case, someone else is growing. So moving sort of up the ladder of intensity of agriculture, this is a community garden in Santa Monica. I believe it's been there for a while. So community gardens are an excellent way to use a larger spot of land to allow people who don't have their own private land or who want to garden in a community to get their plots and to grow food. And there's a lot of good community gardens in Los Angeles. The Center for Food and Justice has produced two versions of something called the Los Angeles Fresh Food Access Guide in the past. We're coming out with the third updated edition fairly soon. And that has lists of all the community gardens, all the farmers markets, a lot of places you can get fresh food in LA. So in a couple weeks or month, you can check out our website and hopefully you can get some copies of those. So moving up the ladder again to urban farms to talk about a situation that probably many of you have heard about, the South Central Farm was a fairly large plot of land that has a sort of rich and twisted history as being a warehouse space, being proposed for an incinerator, being turned into a community garden, and eventually a really sort of urban community and farm, and then unfortunately destroyed. And I'm going to come back to this story later on, but I wanted to sort of proof that you can think about farms of the size of 5 acres, 10 acres, 15 acres in a place like Los Angeles, that they are possible, even if they're hard to sustain. And again, because it's not always possible to grow all the food you're going to need yourself or with your neighbors, your community, but there is a lot of local agriculture in a 50 or 100 mile radius around LA, the question is, what are some ways to sort of rebuild an infrastructure and logistics of like food processing and food distribution that have really been destroyed as agribusiness has grown and national food markets and global food markets have come around? So some of my colleagues at the Center for Food and Justice, who've tried to get a lot of good food into institutions like schools, they've thought about this for the past couple of years with a project to figure out what's the best models for connecting local farmers to especially institutions that buy large amounts of food in LA. So one of the ideas is a local food line, by which we sort of mean a brand, which is the idea that if you're a buyer and you're buying a lot of food and you need like carrots and celery and tomatoes and 5 other things for your salad or whatever, you're not going to want to go negotiate with 5 or 10 different farmers to get those. But if someone else has sort of put together that package of food items you need so you can get them at a certain place, or that they can all be dropped off at a certain point, you can pick them up, then that makes it a lot easier and facilitates those connections. Along the same lines, people are thinking about how you use farmers markets as hubs for food distribution beyond individual shoppers going there. This is a mosaic of the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where if you've been there, you probably see, if you go early, there's already like restaurants and people like that, boutique distributors going there early to get food and buy it in large quantities. Well, the question is, can you use the farmers market management structure, particularly the person who's the manager, to broker some of those connections that I was talking about? If you're a school district, if you're a hospital, if you're a restaurant chain, and you want some food, you can almost give the list to the management at the farmers market, and they hook you up with the different farmers, so you don't have to go stall to stall to negotiate. And the final model along these lines is something you might describe as a farmer collaborative, which again is the idea, something that falls short of a formal cooperative arrangement or formal business co-op like Sunkist or some of the milk co-ops or something. But it's like a bunch of local farmers get together and they can supply different items. And if they get together and lease a delivery truck or if they have a warehouse or something, then that can be sort of a one-stop shopping for people to get local food. And you put that together with growing food and distributing food locally, you can start to rebuild kind of a local food infrastructure and culture in Southern California. All that exciting stuff is happening sort of with people doing it on their own, but that doesn't mean that there can't be a need for policies to make kind of developments accelerate. So when I was thinking about this, one thing might be is that there really isn't a local food vision coming from a Los Angeles officialdom that says anything about, we as a city of LA want to promote local food and here's how we're going to do it. And there's also actually really no structure or staff to implement it if they did have a vision. There are good people in different city council offices. There are agencies that have a certain interest in like economic development in food. But there's no like single staffer who's like, I'm here to make sure that people in LA get enough healthy, affordable food to eat, and it happens in a sustainable way that improves the environment and the economy. And so that might be something to think about. Also, for a long time, groups both are interested in food and community gardens, but also like in parks and other issues have wanted to get an inventory of public and vacant land in LA because, you know, it's a crowded place, but it's also a very large place with a lot of underutilized space. And that's another real need to figure out where in the hell there is actually land that can be used for things like gardens and also other positive enterprises. You can think about removing obstacles to and creating support and incentives for urban ag and gardens. And thinking this, like if you want to remove your lawn and put in a garden, but you're living in a gated community or a place that has like a neighborhood association or whatever, and that has rules against taking out lawn or has rules about maintaining a certain amount of grass space, you can be in trouble. And some states have basically said that can't be in the covenants. You can't stop people from putting in low water things or alternative kinds of landscaping. I don't think we have that in California, so we should try to get that. You can also try to require that new developments have garden space. They've tried to do this a little bit in Vancouver to mixed success, But if you're having a big building in that has a lot of roof space, or we already have some requirements about public art that usually end up with really ugly statues in the middle of a concrete. So the question is, could you require developments, especially those that have like, they're politically sensitive and the developers are willing to give in some concessions, can you require them to have garden space? You can have public agencies procure local food. That creates a market right away. If you have all the schools, the city buildings, the county, et cetera, the parks and recs buying food. And I'm being very modest here. I mean, transportation, economic development agencies at least consider local food distribution strategies because they haven't, it's basically just off the radar screen entirely. And that's the little hopeful last thought. So thanks a lot.
Mark Valianatis is the policy director for the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College and the author of the next Los Angeles, The Struggle for a Livable City. Finally this week, a lost pet teaches Walker Smith a little lesson. Our City Views commentator has learned that some things only come to those who wait.
The one thing that has made me the most impatient with myself over the years is my impatience. I never practiced patience very well because I wasn't practiced at being patient. I remember coming home one night after a long, frustrating day and finding my wife in tears in the yard calling for the cat. We had just moved into a new house, and she was afraid to let our 2-year-old cat run free around the neighborhood, so she had bought a cat leash to take him out into the yard. But he had gotten away from her hours ago, and now that the sun had set, she was becoming very worried. This was the last straw for me that day, so I went prowling up and down the neighborhood in a bad mood for an hour looking for the cat. No luck. I was going into the back door even more frustrated when I heard the cat meow under the back stoop. On my knees, I reached in as far as I could and snagged a bit of leash. I dragged him out and into the house and started to stomp off impatiently to complain to my wife. Just then, I heard a faint gag behind me and realized that in pulling the leash, I had cinched it around his neck and he was choking. I grabbed a knife and cut it off, and he was okay. But had I taken 3 more steps into the house, I would never have heard him, and it would have been too late. It was nothing but my furious impatience over something very silly. I began to try and master my impatience with things around the house, but quickly discovered that I was not very good at it, no matter how hard I tried. My problem was that I hadn't practiced being patient, and I couldn't master it by just trying to be patient around the house. I had to practice being more patient in every part of my life, especially work. This was the hardest thing of all. I am obsessive about work, so learning to patiently approach projects and clients did not come easy. But patience is not something you can do in one area and not another. The more I practice patience in everything, the more patient I am, no matter what I'm doing. It is true that practice makes perfect, but it must be practice in all domains. This is true of everything we want to master. It was in this regard that I read an article in the New York Times recently about why there was no so-called Bradley effect in the presidential polls about Obama before the election. This is the problem of white people not truly telling pollsters their likelihood of voting for a black candidate, thus overstating the vote that the black candidate might get. As this article noted, research has shown that as people spend more time with each other, prejudice and racial stereotypes diminish, even vanish entirely. Thus, as we have become a more integrated, ethnically diverse society, we have become more practiced in tolerance and open-mindedness. It is not something that happens just by wanting to do it. We have to practice it in every aspect of our lives. We have to be immersed in it. Nor is it something that we are impervious to once we start to practice it. Once we are immersed in diversity and more practice with dealing with it, greater tolerance is the inevitable result. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, and he comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. We get great comments from our listeners, and some listeners have suggested books for us to read or a guest we could have on the show, such as a listener in Toronto who suggested we interview Anthony Pearl. Others have written in to tell us what we're doing right and wrong. One listener in particular wrote in with a problem about last week's show. He writes, "The topics discussed are enlightening and interesting, but regarding infrastructure investment, we need to address our bridges, roadways, and a modern train system between major hubs. However, when the cities like Chicago pursue the Olympics instead of making wise investments, one questions the qualifications of the city financial and planning acumen." Just to reassure our listener, in fact, Chicago's Olympics investments will in fact be made in transportation improvements, especially in modernizing CTA, which all of us who depend on CTA on a daily basis will be most happy about. But it's an interesting point, and if you have a point to make, write us at questions@smartcityradio.com or head to our website and click the contact button. While you're there, you can listen to archived shows and subscribe to our podcast and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our frostbitten producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.